Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
And then came back down with that backpacker bus and then came back to Europe, and then I flew here.
Okay.
Just in 2001, in the summer, just to see if I could line up a job in the future, and just to talk to winemakers. So I had a few, I met a few people and went to wineries, and I ended up eventually at Sullivan Vineyards in Rutherford. And I didn't realize that they were interviewing me. I thought they were kind of strange because they were asking all these questions. But after 15 minutes, they asked me if I wanted to stay for harvest. And I was like, let me think, yes. And so they're like, can you start tomorrow? I was like, no. I don't have a house. I don't have a car. I don't have my papers to work here. So we worked it out, and I did the crush in 2001 with them. And super happy to be here. In 2002, I became the viticulturist and the winemaker at Sullivan, and stayed there until early 2010.
When you initially came to the U.S., was the purpose just to work a harvest and then go back?
No. Initially, I was just trying to see if I could get contacts and then I was going to go back to France and then work on those contacts and try to get a job line up. But it just happened. It was really unexpected again. But I was very happy it happened.
So you became a winemaker, a record, quite quickly within a year. Clearly, you
impressed
them. Yes,
because I bugged them so much that they let me do one tank my way.
Oh.
And it turned out to be the better Merlot. And so that was what. And I just talked a lot. And eventually they gave up and said, okay, you do it. with heavy supervision initially, because they know me. And it was just trust that they gave me. But they were still watching a lot.
So you learned the winemaking by observation, largely.
A bit at Chateau Clark. It's observation, it's tasting and tasting and tasting and tasting.
Got it.
At the time when I started at Chateau Clark, it was Jacques Boissonneau, who was the consultant. And in the middle of harvest, they changed to Michel Roland.
So Little-known name.
Even though I didn't know much about wine at the time, it was very interesting to see how in the cellar, all of a sudden, the treatment became very different. And I was like, why are they doing this? Why are they doing that? And so it was a good learning experience. And then all the time I was at Chateau Clark, Michel Roland was the consultant. And he stayed there for years. And now they have another one. But it's Eric Boissonneau, who's the son of Jacques Boissonneau. So it's mainly practice, but it's always practice.
Of course.
When you learn.
And you were a vineyardist at the same time, because you shared that you spent a lot of time in the
vineyard. Yes. So, the vineyard is super important because that's where the quality is made.
Yeah.
And then when you bring it in the cellar, you start at a certain level and you can only go down.
Yeah.
You cannot elevate from what the fruit has naturally. So the best job you can do is to maintain that potential and just bring it to the fore, but you can also mess it up.
What was it like being around Michel Roland at the time?
Oh, he's super friendly. He's a really nice guy. Uh-huh. He's got a very good human touch.
Oh, very good.
So he's very good at psychology.
But so
he's a very quick taster, and he tastes really well.
Does he have a super? Is there some superhuman qualities we should know about with respect to how precise he is and how revered he is for his palate?
I think he has a tremendous sense of understanding of wine, and of balance. He has a definite taste, but he's got good taste. I mean, there are different styles of wine within his style. He's very good at it. And so other people have told me, and tasting, they line it up, and then he tastes, they have a blend. He's like, can you try a little 2% Cap Franc here? And boom, that little thing makes the wine shine. So he's got with time you develop that. Winemakers okay. develop that. But in the end, it's all practice. I mean, it's all, you know, you can think that the different elements, the different lots will work well together.
Yeah.
When you blend them, it doesn't always work out. What the model you created in your head doesn't always work out. The reality is different. So it's a question of tasting and blending. And so it's a lot of blending. If you do it for so many years, you become good at it.
Obviously, you have a catalog in your brain yes. of so many
It's a database,
and then
you know, you learn to sense and taste and look for what you're trying to achieve.
Yeah, because that part is an art form. It has to be.
It's subjective. Yeah.
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 So you stayed at Sullivan for how many years?
Almost 10 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
And
that's where I started my wine in 2004, Hesperia.
Okay.
I was very happy making wine for them, no problem. I had taken over and it was my creative output. But we used to buy a little bit of fruit from a vineyard in Coombsville. We were more interested in the Cap Franc and Petit Verdot. Because they made a Bordeaux blend, and they only grew Cabernet Sauvignon and mm-hmm. Merlot. And I felt that they needed a little Cap Franc and Petit Verdot to do a real Bordeaux blend. And that vineyard had those two, but it had some Cab. So in 2003, they bought the Cab. It was a deal. And then they said, well, we don't want the Cab because we grow plenty. And I loved that Cab. And so I was like, oh, no, okay. So I looked at what I had in my bank, and I was like, I'm not doing anything with this. I can buy these fruit with it. I asked the Sullivans if I could make the wine there, and they agreed. So I bought some big fermentation barrels on the rollers. And those were my aging barrels, too. And that's how the adventure started for Hesperian.
So tell us about Hesperian, the name.
Oh, Hesperian means of the West or okay. relating to the West in Greek.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to have a French name on my label here because it's an English-speaking country.
Yeah.
There's plenty of French labels in France. But I was okay with Latin and Greek because it's the root of our languages in part. And so Hesperian is a Greek word.
Okay.
Yeah.
How many cases did you make in 2004?
In 170.
Wow. And who were you selling your wine to?
Not very many people. Not very many. Because I was so excited. I was like, it's mine. I don't give a damn what anybody's saying. I will make it to be good in 20 years, and I don't care. And so I made this super extracted, massive wine. That I thought was fantastic, but when I presented it to, I think it was Lauby, he just trashed it. He gave me an 81, and I was like, yes, and
yeah,
I was like,
okay,
they're not getting my wine anymore. And then I had some people tasted, and yeah, it was extremely tannic, but I was like, well, you're a professional, you can see through it, but clearly not. So at one point, I just got frustrated with it, and I just put it in storage, and I said, I'll bring it out when it's ready. And I started, by that time, I started selling the 06s mm-hmm. that weren't as extracted and as big, and they presented much better.
Same fruit and source.
Different fruit source.
Okay.
So in 04 and 05, it was Harry's Vineyard mm-hmm. In Coombsville. And so also in 06, 07, 08. And by that time, I thought I hadn't started selling yet, so it was exciting. It was fun. I started making a bunch of single vineyards, 100% Cab, from different appellations to showcase terroir. And because people understand intellectually when you tell them what terroir is, you know, the influence of the soil and the climate and how you grow it. And but when you taste them, it's a different thing. And people couldn't believe it, you know, side by side, they're like, but it's all Cab? Yes, the only difference is where they grew. And so it was an interesting teaching tool, but I would only make 50 cases of the single vineyards and then a blend of mm-hmm. them. And so I don't know if I brought some 07 today, but I brought some 04. for later.
04, yeah. The infamous 04, yeah. That you created. Can't wait to try it.
And so, 06, I started making this single vineyard. So I had like five different Hesperians. Mm-hmm. And that's when I started my second label, Anatomy.
Okay.
Which was at the time was the lots that didn't make it into Hesperian in terms of structure and power and intensity. Mm-hmm. But it made for wine that could be drunk very quickly. That was more round, a little more fruit forward, a little easier going. Because Hesperian is a bigger wine, more tannic, and it gets better with time. Even today, it's fairly tannic in its youth, although I've tamed that a little bit. But it tastes better after 5 to 10 years. But you can drink Anatomy, next year, almost immediately.
So it's more of a welcoming wine.
Yes. Yeah. and less expensive.
Yeah. So you attracted to Coombsville. It's cooler climate.
Yes.
AVA and just, in terms of your mentality, you talked about the elegance, the refinement. Mm-hmm. You wanted to craft wines that are age worthy.
Yes.
Is that at the core of your philosophy?
Yes. That was the core of my philosophy. I think I also went through a personal evolution in terms of my taste.
Okay.
I really liked those big tannins when I was younger. I was just like, I just want to get like punched in the face. It was just like really big, but I enjoyed that sensation. I don't so much anymore. I really veered much more towards elegance. I was more into like those really big wines, not in terms of alcohol, but in terms of structure. I'm not convinced anymore because for me it was what I needed to do for age worthiness. Mm-hmm. I work a little differently now in that I think it's really your vineyard is going to do that or not, and then in the winemaking, I try to still make them age worthy, but I don't extract as much so that I can pour them earlier. And then I work differently with the yeasts and with temperatures. Mm-hmm. Also because my vineyard now is, the vines grow on rocks. It's extremely tannic.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been, since I'm working with this fruit, it's been an exercise in taming tannins.
Mm-hmm.
And so to do that, I've had to really reduce my extractions, my pump overs, lower the temperature. Because I ended up with this drying tannins on the finish, which is not a quality.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's been learning in the vineyard to change my farming practices to soften the tannins, and in the cellar, change my techniques to not have such a rough wine.
Hmm. When did you leave Sullivan and became a full-time?
2010.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's it was in the during that time that I was in the process of negotiating and doing all the due diligence to purchase the winery, and so it just happened to fall at a good time.
Yeah. So you decided to go at it on your own.
Yes.
Which is a formidable undertaking.
Oh yes.
It's a tough business.
It was pretty scary the first year. I was like, what did I do? Especially 2011 being my first vintage.
Oh my goodness.
So in the end, it didn't end up in Hesperian.
Really?
I didn't make any Hesperian. I mean, I fermented the grapes. I was still buying some at the time. I had two other vineyards. I did them as if it was going to be Hesperian in terms of oak regimen. But it was a cold and rainy vintage. I didn't think the structure was there, the power was there. And so it ended up being a fantastic Anatomy, the second label. But it has to be fair to the consumer too. I don't like selling. So I prefer working way harder in the vineyard than in the cellar to make a good wine so that it's easier to sell.
Mm-hmm.
It almost sells by itself, but not really. Rather than push a product that's not it. And it's not good for your brand, and it's not fair to consumers. So I just did not want to do that. If it's not there, it's not there.
Viticulturally speaking, your practices, how have they evolved? I mean, working with that site for a number of years now.
A lot of my experience was on the valley floor, with deep soils, fertile soils. Sometimes the water table was high. I kept telling people, you have to stress your vines, you have to stress your vines. Over there, it's too much stress. Mm. And so now I'm like, water them. And so I've had to learn to water more, which was really something I didn't like doing. But I was stressing the vines too much. They were shutting down, and the evolution and tannins wasn't continuing. And so that's why I had, in part, those rough, drying tannins. So I'm watering a little more. And I also deleaf way less than I used to. In the early days, when I was at Sullivan, we get these massive heat waves in September and October, more and more so. It's becoming pretty regular now. Mm-hmm. And that's a very sensitive time for the berries when they're black already, so they'll absorb more heat. But the skins are starting to loosen up and soften up, so they're more sensitive to direct sunlight. When they're green, it's not a problem. As soon as they start changing color, they become more sensitive. And with direct sunlight, you burn a lot of aromatics. And so I want to preserve those aromatics. And I do like a little bit of an herbaceousness in wine. I find it makes it more interesting, especially in Cabernet. If it's all fruit, it's kind of a little boring, I find. So with a little more leaves, you get a little less of those herbal characters blown off and burned by the sun. But it's a fine balance because you want enough light so that the skins are harder, tougher, and it helps in developing color and some of the aromas. But if it's too much, then you burn it. So it's a fine line. And but so that was also a change in the viticulture. And I have shorter canopies than I used to also. Because that way you don't produce sugar too fast. It forces the grapes to hang a little longer without accumulating too much sugar, so that the tannins can be more in tandem with the sugar. Often in warm climates like here, the sugar accumulation goes faster than the tannins ripen. Mm-hmm. Ideally, they come together when you pick them. But often we wait so that the tannins are ready, because you can't change the tannins. You can play with the sugar in the wine, but not with tannin structure. And so you wait to pick, and then your sugar is super high, and then you end up with a high alcohol wine. This is a simple solution for it. You just drain some of the juice as soon as you crush. It's just sweet juice. And then you replace it with some water. So that you lower the initial bricks of your wine, and then you can have a wine that's more in balance in terms of alcohol. And I don't like too high in alcohol. I mean, when it starts going over 15, I don't really like it. I like drinking wine for its aromas and for its flavors. It's not so much a question of alcohol. And I find if there's too much alcohol, then it becomes aggressive. Mm-hmm. Yes, it gives you more viscosity, it makes it seem bigger, but that's not what I'm looking for.
You have a very distinct, well-articulated point of view.
Thanks.
Is it something you honed in on over the years through your winemaking and wine tasting experience?
It's an obsession. It's a devouring obsession.
Well, I think it almost has to be.
Yes, I think so. If you want to do something really well, it has to be a passion.
Yeah.
Although I say that, but I think that my wines are better now than they were before because I'm a little removed from it. Before it was all passion, and now I remove myself a little bit. I look at it a little more clinically and say, yeah, hold on. What's really going on here? Like, let's just be really technical about it. I mean, I still have the passion, but it's a little more subdued now. I have it a little more under control, where I can actually take a rational decision than just base it on gut feeling and experience. It's very important to work with a vineyard for a few years because they're all different. And so you learn your fruit and how to best express them. Not only work them in the vineyard, but how to really carry them through in the tank and during fermentation.
Is that a motivation behind you purchasing a vineyard? Because clearly you had a choice of sourcing fruit.
It's huge. There's an inherent conflict between a grower and a buyer. Because the grower obviously wants, you know, he's farming to make money on his vineyard. So he's looking at dollars per acre.
Yep.
And that means bigger berries, more fruit per vine, etc. And a winemaker wants smaller berries so that the wine's more intense.
Yeah.
So there's always that pull between the grower, and so you want to be nice about it to get the message through, and then. But there's a point where you can only go so far, and so over there, I mean, the point. I mean, I do sell some grapes at this point to help with paying bills for farming and real estate taxes. Mm-hmm. But the goal is to make wine, and so I farm them for my winemaking, and not to get dollars per acre. Mm-hmm. And I've seen the quality really just jump since I took the vineyards.
So you took more of a purist approach of coaxing as much as you can out of a piece of land.
But that's the interesting part. And to me, you know, I could have gone and bought fruit and all these known vineyards now, here and there, you know, do the regular route that a lot of people do, like, you know, get the right, you know, viticulturist with the right name, get the vineyard that's known, not the right winemaker because I'm the winemaker. But, you know,
at least
these two. That's my fun, goddammit. But what's the point? You know, I would be really proud, and I'm really trying, to get to, like, the perfect wine, whatever that is. I don't think there's such a thing as perfection. But, you know, get to the 100 pointers a few times, and just because it's a reference. But also to take a vineyard that wasn't known and, you know, really reveal its terroir. And I find that much more interesting. It's more difficult, but it's also more interesting.
Everything worthwhile is challenging, isn't it?
Yes.
That's how it works.
Unfortunately.
Darn it. Let's talk about the cellar for a second. What's your barrel program like? What type of cooperage do you use?
It's French oak. Okay. Not because I'm French, but because the structure of the oak is different between American and French oak. They're different species of oak. Mm-hmm. So their flavor components are different, and their molecular structure is different. So the sensory character that American oak brings, for me, is too loud. It's very, has a lot of vanillin and a lot of whiskey lactones, which translates as the coconut flavor. And it's, you know, I'm fine with the vanilla, but coconut shouldn't be in wine.
Draw the line at the coconut.
Yes, or the dill. I hate dill.
No.
That's Missouri oak. And so French oak, typically tight grain because I have plenty tannins up there. The tighter the grain, the less it releases in the wine.
Yeah.
And I have about 5 coopers.
Okay.
Because I like the diversity of it. They all bring a little something different to the wine. Mm-hmm. And one will work better one year, and another one another year, and then the next year maybe another one. I haven't completely refined my barrel program yet because I'm still refining the grapes and the fermentation.
Okay.
And then once I feel that I have that really, I mean, it's an ongoing process. Mm-hmm. I do it a little bit with the barrels. I keep doing trials and things like that, but I don't feel that I'm fully, completely fixed on the barrels. That's still a moving target. There's new oak, depending on the bottlings, more or less, and it's only a question of the wine structure. If the wine's very big, you can put a lot of new oak in it, because it'll absorb the oak and the wine will still speak. If you put a lot of new oak in a wine that's not very tannic, the oak will stand out. And I'm not here to make oak infusions. That's not what I do. It's makeup. And it's a support for the wine. That's how I see it. It should support, enhance the wine, not be the makeup over it.
Supporting role.
Yeah. Almost. For me, it's about the wine, how to bring the wine and have it express its terroir as clearly as possible. And so if you have very loud barrels that are very, like, really bring a lot of their character into the wine, you've lost that.
Yeah.
And so I try to be, sometimes it's 70%, sometimes it's 80% new oak, but sometimes it's 30%. So it really depends on the wine.
Do you always, your aging regime, is it always the same amount of time?
Pretty much, because I did some earlier bottling, about, you know, 15, 16 months earlier on, and I was afraid to get too much oak impact.
Yeah.
And in reality, the wines that I make are too big, they need an extra 5 months. And then they'll express themselves better in the bottle. Otherwise, you have to wait even longer for it to come around in the bottle. So right now, I'm at about 20 months. It seems to be a good number for my wines.
Let's talk about the recent vintages, you know, 15 in particular. We touched upon it when we were walking.
15 is the wine's really good. The critics really liked it. That's when I got my best grades on it. But at the same time, it was a very difficult vintage for me because the weather was too cold in spring during flowering. And so the pollination didn't happen properly. If pollination doesn't happen well, then seeds don't form. But this and the seeds release hormones that make the berry grow. So when they're not there, then they don't release hormones and the berry will drop. It's called shatter. And so I had so much shatter that I picked less than 10 tons on 14 acres.
Wow.
It was really, really just sad and distraught. Sure. And, you know, in the end, the wine was good, but I started picking it with Juan Carlos, my vineyard guy. We were picking it by hand, and I was de-stemming it by hand. I had taken a few barrels, popped the face off to ferment them in the barrel, not realizing how much work the de-stemming was by hand. And so that lasted only 3 barrels. And then I said, no, I'm getting a crew to pick, and then we fermented it regularly, you know, normal. But the wine was really good in the end, but there was very little of it.
Yes, and then how was the 16?
The 16 was a cooler vintage. I liked them very well, very much. Much more aromatic, I think, because it was a cooler vintage. And in that vintage, I have 3 different Hesperians.
Okay.
I like it. It's interesting. I did some ripeness trials that vintage, because I wanted to really get to know my vineyards, and I wanted to do it in 15, but I couldn't. And then so I did it in 16, and I started picking very early, the 6th of November of September, for Mountain Cab. It's super early.
That is very early.
Yes. I had 11.8% alcohol when the wine had finished fermenting. I mean, I really liked it, but I knew it was not going to pass. And then I picked every 2 weeks to see that evolution in ripeness. And of course, it's not fully correct because the vineyard has so much slopes and different aspects that, you know, what's ripe on top at the beginning, you know, I picked the bottom part a month later, because it's cooler down there and it takes longer to ripen. So that in the end became 3 wines that were based on ripeness.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.